making TV special.
Dennis. Made with creamy butter.
And you know what that means?
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another special interview episode from Media Monarchy. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you on a hot Portland, Oregon evening. It's July 30th, 2009. And on the line is Bill Fox, a former Marine Corps major and also a contributor and writer to the Lone Star Iconoclast and also a member of Ghost Troop. Bill Fox, thanks for taking the time.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I think that you're performing a valuable public service to help folks stay abreast of the real possibility that we might get hit with another false flag attack, just like 9/11. So, as a matter of fact, go ahead.
In order to basically give some background to folks and why, you know, it may seem funny that, you know, some hippie punk kid here in Portland, Oregon is on the phone with a former military man. What would bring, you know, two seemingly strange bedfellows together? And that is the mass amount of military and terror exercises going on across the country. We had Ardent Century drills, which we covered in great detail on Media Monarchy. And we're now soaking in the middle of National Level Exercise 09 to be followed immediately by another drill called Vibrant Response. So if you can give folks just a little bit of background on yourself and how perhaps we came to be talking on the phone today.
Sure. Well, first off, I think 9/11 was the great turning point, and for those who have really investigated it, they may come to the conclusion, as I did, that not only was it an inside job, but in all likelihood, it was a Mossad CIA inside job. And in fact, I've created at my website, AmericaFirstBooks.com, a series titled the Mission of Conscience series about Captain Eric May and Ghost Troop and then others like myself who've come on board. And basically it lays out everything from soup to nuts, how all this started. So I want to at least make sure that your listeners have that as a good resource. I've spent certainly quite a lot of time trying to lay it out on the internet as a resource. So for everything that I say in this interview, you can probably find at least going from when Captain May first got involved with the creation of Ghost Troop up until Operation Top Off in Portland, which was in October 2007. It covers all the deep background and provides extensive documentation. Now, to answer some other parts of your question, I can answer that for both Captain May and then also for myself. The short answer is for Captain May, as he got started, after the he became aware of what was called the Battle of Baghdad cover-up, and that took place, of course, in April 2003, when right when we had the situation where we were told by major media that it basically been a roll-in operation into Baghdad with very little fighting, just a handful of casualties. And in fact, Captain May discovered that it was a very different situation, that had been very extensive casualties and even strong evidence that either one or more neutron bombs had been used at the Baghdad airport. That was completely covered up. Then flashing forward, he became aware by January and into February of 2004 that 9/11 was an inside job from a Marine Corps captain, Jeff Cross, who had been only a few blocks from the World Trade Center towers as part of a what was called a boots to business program, learning the ropes in certain areas to take on a civilian job. And in any event, when the World Trade Center towers came down, Captain Cross became convinced. He felt the explosions and the earth shaking and knew it was due to, at a minimum, controlled demolitions. So Captain May then, some things really clicked mentally, and he felt that not only was it a question of 9/11 having been inside job, but the press was talking about how it's not a question of if but when we'll have a repeat 9/11. And so the the March 11th, 2004 Madrid bombings became a major turning point for Captain May that convinced him that, in fact, we have a global phenomenon of in the global war terror, where Mossad CIA is actually manipulating global media and political sentiments of countries around the world, to include the U.S., to serve a new world order and pro-Zionist agenda, among other things, among other interest groups that are closely allied with them. So then, I'm trying to give your listeners an overview. We can flash forward where I, speaking of Portland, I can relate to Portland, having lived in your area from 1994 up until around 2007. I was in the Portland-Vancouver area, part of time in Portland, other part in Vancouver, Washington. And in fact, I got very active in summer 2007 when I became very concerned with an exercise, Noble Resolve, that could go live and create a real threat to Portland. There was a scenario which entailed a 10 kiloton nuke going off first a little bit north of Portland, Burlington, Northern Bridge, and then at the Steel Bridge, with either a nuke or explosive nuke or a what's called a radiation dispersal device. And that culminated in the top-off exercise in October 2007, where we think things came pretty close to actually getting sucked into another adventure in the Middle East, an attack on Iran. So that's sort of a broad brushstroke approach, quite a lot of things to talk about, but how both Captain May and I got involved.
There are, and Noble Resolve, as well as the top-off exercises, are something that myself, as well as to a greater degree, other Portland folks such as Alex Ansary of Outside the Box and Clyde Lewis at the Ground Zero Lounge, both and all three of us tracking the drills and the, you know, black helicopters, literally, you know, black helicopters flying around, not the crazy conspiracy theory. And that's what brings us together, is that when we talk about 9/11 and we talk about 7/7 in London, we have drills going on at the exact same times in the exact same places that seem to mirror the events that they were only practicing for,
right?
Which the odds of which are astronomical and impossible. So that's why, and that would be my question, why do we then pay attention to these drills going on?
Right. As a matter of fact, if you don't mind, throughout this interview, I'm going to reference different chapters in my online series, Mission of Conscience.
Please, and those links will be included in the show notes. So,
right. I just want to I want, of course, point this out to your listeners so they can get the deep background, where I've gone to great lengths to kind of really lay things out with documentation for things that I can only briefly touch on in sound bites. I mean, I could spend a whole hour, or just on even sections of each chapter of this book, and I've got now 26 chapters online, 13 for book one and 13 for book two. But in chapter eight, well, I have chapter seven, how September 11th became the false flag Rosetta Stone, and then chapter eight, which is 9/11 patterns as future false flag indicators. You can find the chapter listings in either the Captain Eric May or my own archive, William B. Fox archive, at americafirstbooks.com. An alternate URL you can type is amfirst, amfirstbooks .com. But anyway, there is an important logic I'll try to go over briefly behind why they have major exercises. One is that, first of course, with the concept of false flag exercise, is that the power elite is carrying out an attack against it's high treason against their own countrymen, and blaming it on foreigners like Al-Qaeda, some foreign construct. And so, first off, you know, this is high treason, so they want to make sure of several things. First of all, they don't get caught because they can hang from the lamppost, or they could trigger a military coup or whatever. Since basically 9/11, we believe, was actually a coup against America, so they're afraid of a counter coup. The other thing, too, is there could be parts of the military that react to all this in an unforeseen way. And so they really need to have these things very well choreographed, and they need to be in a command center where they can control the military as well as the national media reaction. So, ironically, the most ideal time. Also, they like to have the government, the top government insiders who are part of this, like to make the government look competent, like it has things under control. So, frankly, I've discovered from my own government experience that quite a few people in the government are not really that swift mentally. They're not really that good at analytical intelligence. They have to be sort of trained about how to do things before they do it right. And furthermore, it's a good idea in the military, before you go out on patrol, you rehearse everything that you're going to do as much as you can, simulate it as much as possible before you actually do it. That's just common sense, particularly when you're doing things that are dangerous. So it turns out that actually running an exercise is really a major exercise is the only time they can really have enough pieces of the jigsaw puzzle under control to actually carry out a false flag operation and minimize the risk of blow up in their face. And actually, we're discovering from quite a lot of our 9/11 research, as well as the London subway bombing research, that they really have to choreograph a lot of this stuff, not only with deception elements during the actual operation, but also as part of the sustained cover-up afterwards. It's a big deal, and you typically need a state-supported intelligence operation like Mossad or CIA to be able to carry off something this complex. Plus, you typically need control of local media. We find that areas are typically prepared years in advance. Everything I say obviously should bring up more questions. Obviously, your listener's saying, well, they're preparing in advance, who could be so powerful and so far-sighted that they would be orchestrating all this, and why? Those are good questions. Another reason why I went to the great lengths of creating this online series to try to answer all these questions.
So that, I think, hits it right there for me, is these types of drills and exercises fulfill a multitude of reasons. It gives the feds and the higher-ups the opportunity to set up a large exercise where they can involve the federal and state and local law enforcement agencies, as well as then those local media agencies. And, of course, they're vying to get the hot interviews and the coverage for these stories. And of course, they always write their headlines that begin with some, it may have looked like the end of the world, but it was just an exercise, some silly thing to make it all just seem like it's just for play. But it, of course, also acclimates, I think, people to getting used to the idea of seeing the military roll down their street.
Right.
And even, you know, when we talk about these drills, even Jim Jones in Jonestown, they had drills of practicing drinking the Kool-Aid. So that
right.
when the time came, it was no big deal, and they did it. Now, of course, we're not going to dive into that whole black hole here. But if we can jump to the present, and as we've talked about these events, and we've talked about how many of them are surrounded by drills, what is important and perhaps different about what is happening right now, the national level exercise?
Well, as a matter of fact, I sent out a email to that is titled "Request for Submission of Suspicious Activity Indicators Involving DHS, Department of Homeland Security, FEMA, and Other Federal Personnel During National Level Exercise 2009," taking place, of course, from 27 to 31 July. I sent it out to all the county sheriffs, like in Texas and Louisiana. Actually, I got a very favorable reply from one sheriff in particular. He said he doesn't believe in DHS stuff anymore, and he said, right on, good luck to you. But, for example, right now with this national-level exercise, one of the most troubling things is we haven't been given solid scenario information by the Department of Homeland Security. Anytime we have a major level exercise, that's a cause of concern, because typically, for example, 9/11 involved, of course, DHS hadn't been created yet, but we had everybody else at the highest levels involved. So that's usually an important red flag. Some things that were unique about NLE 2009? Well, first off, there was this talk about focusing exclusively on terrorism prevention and protection. Actually, somebody saw a Freudian slip there. What are they going to do? Focus on terrorism protection as if, and you know, we're going to protect internally generated false flag terrorism.
We're going to exactly. We're going to protect the terrorists because they may be triple agent patsies.
Exactly.
The kind of the pun and the Freudian slip there.
Yep. So, also, another interesting element here. Supposedly, this is the first major exercise, according to the FEMA news release, to focus exclusively on the terrorism aspect and response recovery. Also, another red flag, they talked about participation of Australia, Canada, Mexico, and the United Kingdom. In other words, for people who are concerned about national sovereignty, why this thing about bringing foreign troops on our soil, just like, in fact, the Mexican troops brought into the U.S. during the Katrina catastrophe. I have tried to reach points of contact with FEMA and DHS, and nobody's given me a straight answer, which is another red flag. The Coast Guard, which, of course, is directly underneath the Department of Homeland Security, is talking about small boats coming in. We see these different news blurbs coming into the country. But I think the lack of just honest discussion of scenarios. For example, I contacted a public information officer for the Houston Police Department, and she told me they normally do not discuss DHS-related training activities with the public because they're classified. So she suggests I submit an open records request to Houston Police Department. Well, they got back to me and said, well, what documents? And then I said to them, well, how can I know what documents? Because you haven't told me anything, and I'd be happy to come on down and actually look through file folders or whatever, and I haven't heard back from them. So I'm getting the runaround.
The runaround, exactly. So the one thing we do know, in addition to this involving foreign troops and FEMA, some of the private military contractors, where I think is where it starts to get a little darker, and who is perhaps involved in these drills. We know, at least, that Northrop Grumman and Battelle, out of Columbus, Ohio, are involved in this drill. And now we've seen, I believe earlier in the week, and I'll interrupt my thought by saying there has been a lot of talk and chatter about these exercises going on. Just a quick glance at YouTube and Twitter just a little bit ago, there are a lot of folks out videotaping things, looking at what's going on, seeing if there's any kind of troop movement or equipment moving or anything suspicious going on, which is a good thing that so many eyes have now been put onto these drills.
Right.
But we've now seen in the last day, I believe even only just in the last few hours, we have a chemical fire in Texas.
That's right, not far from College Station, where Texas A&M is located. Yeah, that looks real suspicious, particularly given if you look at the map of the large evacuation zone near that, and it looks, yeah, you have Army hazmat unit operating there. So then there's the question about whether this may have been part of a scenario.
So this, and to tell folks as well that this drill, being run in part by FEMA, is taking place in FEMA's Region 6, which includes Arkansas, Louisiana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas.
Right, five states. The other thing, of course, you had the Kurt Nemo did a great article, North Carolina Terror Arrest Time to Coincide with NLE 09. Somebody can Google that.
Exactly. The bust of I believe his name
this
is
guy, Daniel
Boyd.
Patrick Boyd.
Exactly. Please, can you elaborate on just the timing?
Yeah, well, I just reading from the article, it says on Monday, the Fed swooped down on alleged terror group plotting murder mayhem in North Carolina. Federal indictment against the group claims Raleigh drywall contractor, Daniel Patrick Boyd, and his associates sought to wage violent jihad abroad and engage in military-style training at home, according to the Associated Press. It said Boyd, a poster child for, quote, white al-Qaeda, unquote, if there ever was one, trained at a terrorist camp in Afghanistan in the late 1980s and fought against Soviet occupation of that country. The article goes on to talk about how actually everything associated with it been sponsored directly by, at the highest levels, by the CIA. Of course, we know Bin Laden himself was sponsored by the CIA. And so it just seems, I like the way the article wraps. It says, the feds claim they prevented a terrorist attack in North Carolina. This is a well-orchestrated propaganda effort timed to coincide with NLE 09. It's particularly important to note this in the wake of the manufactured deluge of propaganda and federal and state reports portraying, quote, right-wing, unquote, domestic terrorist as a threat to the homeland. A particular egregious instance of this propaganda was released in June when the Washington Times, the cornerstone of Operation Mockingbird, reported counterterrorism officials, quote, authenticated, unquote, a video by a supposed Al-Qaeda recruiter who claimed he had the ability to smuggle biological weapon into the United States via tunnels under the Mexico border. In the video, Abdullah al-Nafisi suggested that Al-Qaeda might want to collaborate with, quote, members of native U.S. white supremacist militias who hate the federal government. Gee, isn't that just incredibly convenient that they want to get lovey-dovey with so-called white supremacists?
And this, I think, is what ties it all in, and there is such, and it's reaching such an amazing proportion that I'm still kind of surprised at it day by day, is this confluence of what I call homegrown errorism and this threat of right-wing extremism, and even the talk of the birthers, and all of these things come together also with economic collapse and healthcare and all of these things. And I look right now, just a couple of hours ago on CBSNews.com, Obama participates in terror preparedness test. Healthcare reform was put aside for a time today as President Obama headed to the White House Situation Room to oversee federal efforts to prevent a terror attack on the United States. It was part of an exercise for officials at the highest levels of the U.S. government, National Level Exercise 09.
Right. Well, actually, Captain May, just before this interview, suggested over the phone that he thinks that we're in a very, very dangerous period right now, red alert, extending between now till probably sometime mid to late September. Part of that has to do with the fact that in Israel, this is the prime time for them to fight because they have a maximum number of reservists who can get on active duty during the summer. And we found this pattern in the past
as
well.
This is where we saw their last big offensive, I believe, two or perhaps three summers ago.
Oh, against Lebanon.
Yes.
Right. The 2006 war. Yeah, that was well planned in advance. I go into that in my Mission of Conscience series about how there's extensive planning by the U.S. behind the scenes to support Israel on that.
Also, if I can throw in quickly again to this ugly, sinister stew of things that are all swirling around, and as I've said, a little sidebar here, I sure wish 9/11 truthers got as much coverage as the Obama birthers are getting, but not going there for the time being.
Right. Well, just a few points that we're hitting on to reinforce them a little bit more. Republic Broadcasting Network has posted an article titled "Napolitano Stands Behind Extremism Report" of the Washington Times. That was actually April 15th. That's been out for a while. But it stated that Janet Napolitano, director of Department of Homeland Security, stands by the report sent to law enforcement that lists veterans as a terrorist risk to the U.S. and defines, quote, right-wing extremism, unquote, as including groups opposed to abortion and immigration. And then on the – this is actually in the letter I sent out to county sheriffs, the email. You have Alex Jones, who's talking about how DHS – Department of Homeland Security is fostering training scenarios that demonize American conservatives, militarize police, and condition them to conduct illegal gun confiscations and other violations of citizen rights. He quoted a story that appeared in the News Tribune out of Missouri, Camp Crowder. It says, guard units trained for militia attacks. When I tried to look that up on the internet, apparently the term militia had been sanitized out there. But if you look at Alex Jones, you actually see the headline that has militia stuck in there, guard units trained for militia attacks. Alex Jones also put on the screen a New York Times article in which he talked about how there's a local sheriff's department that in California that was encouraging a group called Explorers. They're similar to the Boy Scouts, to not only do training, paramilitary training going in to get terrorists, but was associating potential terrorists with veterans, people returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, actually, you know, some of this stuff is so extreme, it just speaks for itself. You just really wonder about the mentality of people at these higher levels of Department of Homeland Security, that they're trying to demonize so many different groups in our society.
I've tried to point out on the show and on the website many times that essentially I'm nonpartisan. I think both parties are completely corrupt, and they serve to kind of prop each other up, which, you know, have 8 years of one, and you get tired of those bums, and you throw them out, and you vote in new guys, and seemingly the same agenda rolls forward exactly as we're seeing right now. What I was going to throw in earlier to the nasty stew that we have going brewing right here is we see Obama's approval ratings plummeting. And it just mirrors and echoes to me, one, what we heard Joe Biden and Colin Powell and Madeleine Albright all saying around inauguration time 6 months ago, saying it won't be 6 months before it'll look like, you know, we're floundering and the wheels are coming off and we're going to be tested. Something's going to happen and we're going to be tested. So it'll look bad, but just, you know, stick with us. Follow your new Obamasiah. One other thing, I'm sorry. What it also seems to mirror for me is the summer 8 years ago when we saw George Bush's approval ratings plummeting over a hot summer that we saw him hanging out on the ranch. But seemingly by the end of summer, beginning of fall, a catalyzing, catastrophic event happened.
I just wanted to reinforce the point that you're making there, that that's exactly right. Obama's running out of time. The problem is that we have sort of the Republicrat or Democrat party. It's basically both parties have one thing in common, and that's perpetrate the power and privileges of the elite. And we can go into a long discussion about who they are and what their objectives are and how they got there. But they're relying on smoke and mirrors. And that gets in another discussion about how America's lost its industrial base over the past several decades. And I think a lot of that is due to a very irresponsible criminal mentality of members of the power elite. And they know they're in big trouble. And so they're playing, using every technique in the political book to try to manipulate appearances. And Obama knows that he's living on limited time. I mean, he is not offering change. He's in bed with, I think the biggest Wall Street, his biggest contributor in his campaign was Goldman Sachs.
Yes,
and
they
we've
were.
Seen the all the fun and games they've been through. In fact, there's a great article in Rolling Stone you may have covered mm-hmm. About how they've been engaging in gross manipulation of markets going back to the 1920s at least. And what makes them particularly dangerous is they're able to place their own guys at the highest levels of the government to basically give them various forms of government pork barrel. And so that gets into a whole other discussion about how the big daddy of them all, the Federal Reserve, created in 1913, is privately owned. And that's part of the big old boy network on Wall Street. I can talk about that extensively.
I hadn't even really thought it. That's the other thing to throw into the mix is, of course, the growing chorus of people. I believe we even had the Wall Street Journal making reference to, well, maybe we should audit the Fed. Maybe we do need to break up the Fed. Ron Paul and his work on the audit the Fed, which perhaps ultimately, you know, the devil's advocate negative side of it would be, if they decided to audit it, they would just, again, use that as an excuse to say, oh, gosh, you're right. We were doing it wrong. Give us more money and more power, and we'll do it better next time.
Well, the big danger to them is that the whole construct, the whole concept of the Fed is fundamentally flawed. And I can go into a long discussion. A good starting point for any of your listeners who want to get into the real philosophical meat of this is go to lewrockwell.com or www.mises.org. And at mises.org, listen to the lecture tapes of Dr. Murray Rothbard. or others who criticize the Fed. And there's a great article by Dr. Murray Rothbard, What Has Government Done With Our Money? And
I would also throw in Edward Griffin's Creature from Jekyll Island, as well as the documentary The Money Masters.
Oh, exactly. In fact, at my website, in my audio section, I link to The Money Masters, and I also refer to Griffin's book, which I've read. It's a fantastic book, extremely readable, reads like a detective story. You're absolutely right. Actually, there's quite a lot of good stuff about the Fed that it makes it extremely well documented. I think, but especially after considering the works of Dr. Murray Rothbard, who is an eminent professor at Columbia University, that will give you all the intellectual firepower you need to know that this is not conspiracy crank talk. This is very real. And in fact, if you dig deeper, you find out that it's on the same page as Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson. Thomas Jefferson was an ardent foe of the whole central bank concept. In fact, if you got a moment, I'd like to just spend just a little bit just laying a broad brushstroke overview.
Please. Because this is because we've now, I think, gotten to perhaps the fundamentals of what is going on. Please go ahead.
It's amazing in our conversation here. We seem to be, you described yourself as being in humorous, self-disparaging talk about your background in Portland. I'm really heartened by this interview because here, yourself coming from a very different background from myself, you and I are just so much on the same page, you know, regarding how screwed up this country is. I think that's actually very encouraging because that indicates to me that common citizens across this country have a strong potential to wake up.
Absolutely.
If we just get aggressive and get the word
down,
out.
I think we're breaking down a lot of the phony constructs that keep people from getting together and working together. So please, your broad overstatement.
Well, see, actually, this is important because a lot of people think that finance is complicated, and you say central bank, they almost want to yawn and go to sleep. But you could actually argue that this is a critical driver behind this whole mass of the false flag exercises, that the whole central bank concept and also the fractional reserve banking concept is not sustainable. It was headed towards disaster. It was originally created by people with a criminal mentality who are pursuing immediate political objectives at the expense of the future. Let me just see if I can summarize it very quickly. In early America, you had in the late 1700s, and during the colonial period, in fact, Dr. Murray Rothbard wrote a great work about the history of liberty in America called Conceived in Liberty. And he also wrote a great history of the financial system in America, the banking system, good reference sources. But basically, you had what was called a free money system. And the way that worked is you're basically free to use whatever you want for legal tender. You know, you could use foreign coins, you could use wampum, beaver pelts, playing cards, whatever you want, whatever somebody wants, gold, silver coins. And it turned out, according to Rothbard, in the late 1700s, actually something like half the coins in circulation, the colonies, were French and Spanish coins. But the point we want to make is that actually was a very good system. In California, in the 1800s, through much of the 1800s, they used nothing but gold coins, and it worked. And so, in fact, Voltaire once said that a fiat money system, where you force people to accept paper issued by the government, always returns to its intrinsic value, which is the worth of the paper, is zero. And the idea is that politicians tend to be like alcoholics. You know, you give them the ability to print money, and they're going to abuse it. It's like putting alcoholics in a liquor store. You know, guess what's going to happen? You come back, you know, if you lock them in a liquor store, they're going to drink themselves to death. So the idea is that if you want real liberty in a society, you should do exactly what Thomas Jefferson advocated, and that is keep the creation of money out of the hands of the politicians and leave it in the hands of the people. Keep it decentralized. And the idea that, you know, banking, you don't want an efficient financial system. It's like the jury system and the judicial system. You don't want a certain type of efficiency. And let me push that analogy so people really sort of get it. You know, in our court of law, if you really want efficiency, you just have a judge there and you bring people before a judge and the judge decides the rule of evidence and he decides how long it's going to take. He says guilty, innocent or guilty. Now, that would be efficient in terms of time. You would get all kinds of convictions, put all kinds of people in jail. But is that what you want? No, it's not. Probably because, you know, judges are humans. They're limited. Many of them are corrupt. And you get all kinds of innocent people being sent to jail and also people being put away for political reasons. So in America, we do not want certain kinds of efficiency when it comes to legal system. In fact, we have the jury system, which is extremely inefficient from a time situation. It's costly, takes a long time, but we accept that inefficiency because we want efficiency in another area, which is justice and having our laws grounded in the common sense of the local people and taken out of the political hands of judges and other people. And I'd make the same analogy with the financial system. Under Jefferson and others, he said, you know, he felt that one of the most possible, greatest potential pernicious dangers to our government could come from the financial sector, the ability of financiers to corner the money supply, print money for themselves. That's where we don't want efficiency. We want inefficiency, just like using the analogy with the legal system, where we want to keep it forcefully decentralized. So under Glass-Steagall, we used to forcefully decentralize the banking system among all the different states. And then we also separated investment banking from savings and loans and commercial banking. And I can get into all that if you want, but I digress a bit too much here. But the point is that back in the early 1800s, America experienced very solid growth with a decentralized financial system. In fact, the U.S. Constitution gives Congress the power to coin money, and in this Coinage Act of 1792, the dollar was defined in terms of grains of silver, which in turn was later pegged to gold. So, I mean, just as a little side note there, in a true free money system, you let gold and silver float relative to each other. But I digress too much.
We'll say that, you know, as what you were saying a few minutes ago, is money is essentially anything two people agree on is worth something between the two of them that they can trade.
Right. Now, let me try to deliver an important punchline, and that is, the punchline is that system worked. Okay, America grew very well. It experienced good, solid financial growth. So did you know that by 1913, despite some of the inflation of the war between the states period, the dollar was worth twice as much as it was in 1813? And that the average of America became, the middle class grew throughout the 1800s. The average working man could afford a nice house, and he could afford, his wife didn't have to work, and he could afford a nice big family. And
we know that essentially as well, that two presidents, at least that, you know, full on the record, that tried to take on the banksters were Lincoln and Kennedy.
Well, there's an assassination attempt against Andrew Jackson, as you may call.
Mm-hmm.
He survived that, but he was the one who got rid of another attempt to create the Bank of the, he put away the Bank of the United States. So there had been one under George Washington and one created by, I believe, Madison after Jefferson. And Andrew Jackson revoked the charter. So that's one reason why, although Jackson was a relatively authoritarian president, he was a great hero of American populist. What I'd like to do is, for those people who are unfamiliar with the history, try to give you the broad brushstrokes, is we saw a big overturning of American economic theory ever since agents of the Rothschilds, the Morgans, the Rockefellers snuck through the Federal Reserve Banking Act in 1913. In fact, there's an excellent book by Zygmunt Dodds and the Veritas Foundation at Harvard called Keynes at Harvard, and they talk about basically a coup d'etat in academia, where the professors who taught more of your classical libertarian economics were basically ousted and replaced with professors who promoted a theory of economics that justified big central government and a central bank like the Federal Reserve in the 1930s. So this, if you know where to look, this is documented. There's basically a takeover of America and also a takeover of our media going all the way back. You can look at Henry Ford's series, The International Jew, talking about takeover of major media across the country, about the role of Zionists and other groups. And of course, if you go to, you can go back deeper in terms of the trend towards centralization at LouRockwell.com. Go to the King Lincoln archive, and it talks about how Lincoln ruled as a dictator, and that that sad experience of the war between the states, the war against Southern independence, put America on track towards unlimited government. Prior to the 1860s, all government was kept less than 5% of GDP, and ever since that sad period, it's grown to now it's about 50% of GDP. And you know, to put things in perspective, even back in the medieval period, if somebody got taxed more than 10%, they're considered like a peasant or a serf. And in America, the average American is taxed at about all taxation, excise taxes, state, federal, local, you name it, about 50%. So, you know, we're in a Norwegian society where we're told that we're free, but we're really run by manipulators who control big central government, big central bank, and then we have a very powerful Zionist group who've literally sucked trillions of dollars out of this country, either directly or indirectly, in support for not only Israel, but Zionist projects in the Middle East.
So this kind of flash forward whiplashes us to the present day, and I think if we can kind of put it now simply, that essentially the United States was hijacked a long time ago by foreign interests and the power elite, and you mentioned those names such as the Rockefellers or the Rothschilds, and of course we know the Morgans and all these folks that are still around to this day.
Right.
And the drills, to get to jump back to the right now, if drills are essentially practice, you're practicing something. These drills right. are practicing to take over cities, because it seems as though the engineered collapse is upon us. They want to pull the rug out from under the U.S., just like they've done in countries around the world, documented, if anything, from Naomi Klein and Shock Doctrine and right. Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Those aren't even, you know, fringe conspiracy books. It's fairly well documented, and it basically seems like it's our turn.
Right. Well, basically, we have people with a criminal mentality, the way I see it. And for a long time now, they've been running a system that's not sustainable. And they knew that was coming anyway. They're like, the best analogy I can give is they're like alcoholics. You know, they're people who are brilliant people who are alcoholics. They know they have an alcohol problem. They know it's killing them. They know it's bad. They know they should quit. And they're incredibly intelligent people. They're very charming people. But they're just going to drink themselves to death. They just can't help it. They have a character flaw. And we're dealing with people in the power elite who, in my opinion, have criminal traits where they just can't help turning America into casino society. They can't help trying to make a quick buck. Just like that article in Rolling Stone about Goldman Sachs. I mean, this is not the mentality of Henry Ford. You know, America built an industrial base in the 1800s as large, if not larger, than like Germany, France, and England combined. America, I think the average worker in America had twice the living standard as in Europe. But look at the people who ran America then. People like, you know, Henry Ford, who actually came a little bit later, but then you had Andrew Carnegie and many other captains of industry, a very different mindset than the people who run Wall Street today, who just want to make a quick buck by cutting corners. So what they've done is they've eaten our seed corn. They've outsourced our industrial base, which that's another discussion, a book by Human Fingleton called In Praise of Hard Industries, explains why you need to keep heavy industry at about 30% of GDP. And right now, we've lost over 75% of that to support a real economy. So let me, having given all that philosophical background, yeah, these people have screwed everything up, and they know it. They're scared that the people wake up will come after them and try to hang them from the lamppost. So they want to clamp down on us. They're desperate people, and they're trying every trick in the book, and they're prepared to censor the internet, create nationwide martial law. There's nothing that's too low. There's nothing that's too ruthless that they're not prepared to try to do if we don't stop them, which I guess segues now to NLA. What's the latest outlook, right, on and this other exercise?
And, well, and essentially, too, because, you know, if you're in Texas and I'm in Portland, it seems as though the places that have the most practice in these drills and these exercises are, again, what Captain Eric May, I believe, has gone over, in that it generally seems to look like Chicago, Houston, New York, Washington, D.C., and Portland, Oregon.
Right. If we have just a little more time, I'd like to hit this topic we're into now about our outlook.
Please.
How much more time do we have here?
As much time as you need.
Okay, good. Well, discovered some patterns. Of course, with NLE wrapping up tomorrow on the 31st, that's not the end of our worries. As I mentioned, Captain May, in fact, Captain May thinks that if it were not for this whole flap with Obama's response to the Gates arrest, for those of you listeners who may not be familiar with that story, Obama made a comment. He felt that the Cambridge police who arrested a Professor Gates, who is a director of Harvard University's W.E.B. Du Bois Institute of African and African American Research, when he was trying to get back in his house, they thought maybe he was trying to break in, and they ended up putting him in handcuffs and arresting them. They dropped the charges, but during a White House conference on Wednesday, Obama said officers, quote, acted stupidly, unquote, in arresting Gates, and this infuriated many police organizations. So I believe that very recently he called to have a beer with Gates and policemen there at the White House.
I think that happened today.
Today.
And of course, the only chatter is, what kind of beer did they have? That's the important question.
Well, but Captain May has been wondering if this flap hadn't taken place, whether we might have, in fact, had a false flag attack yesterday on Wednesday. I mean, he thinks we're right on the razor's edge in terms of the possibility of something going down. So now this vibrant response, which is slated to take place from the 31st up until the 14th, I, in fact, spoke with a public affairs specialist at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio. There's some things that are very disturbing about this. In fact, I discussed it with Captain May just before the show. One is they're going to be holding a war game exercises, 400 to 500 specialists. It's like a command post exercise where senior commanders will simulate talking to policemen and governors to manage what will apparently be a scenario with a 10 kiloton nuke going off. And in fact, going back to the Noble Resolve and the Topol scenarios, and even earlier, we've seen quite a few 10 kiloton nuke scenarios in the past that have disturbed us. One reason why it's so scary is we think that the people who are trying to manipulate us feel that after 3,000 Americans died on 9/11, or whatever the true number was, give or take, that they feel they need to increase the fear dose to keep us in line, to keep us in shock. And, you know, it's been a while now since 9/11, 2001, and we think that they really feel like they really need to sock it to us good and hard and get a lot of Americans killed, like maybe 10 or 20,000, and pop off a nuke. Also, setting off a nuke would be, of course, they want to justify not only national martial law and censorship of the internet, but they want to attack Iran. And to go after the nuclear facilities in Iran, they have to use nuclear bunker busters, and we supplied hundreds of those to Israel, and it would be a gory mess. So it turns out that they had actually last year, in the early last year's October 1st, 2008 version of Vibrant Response, they had a 10 kiloton nuclear device scenario being detonated in the heartland then. So I asked if they would repeat this. And of course, it was actually held in 2008. They had the exercise at Fort Stewart, Georgia, with this, among other things, they had this brigade that's been allocated now to U.S. Northcom, which, for those who are concerned about posse comitatus, you know, having a brigade, boots on the ground, take care of us folks here in continental United States, should be worrying, among many other things.
These are guys that are, of course, fresh back from combat, who are now back here. And, of course, this is a different situation, but you're going to have people who may treat it as the same. So whether they're in Baghdad or whether they're in Birmingham.
Yeah, that's another worrisome thing, is these, not only that, but they, because to fill the ranks, they've been taking a lot of foreigners and giving them citizenships. They have
and
some guy raised in,
bangers.
Imagine.
Yep.
Imagine a guy raised in a third world country. All he knows about America is what he's experienced after being granted citizenship by patrolling and beating up people, raiding homes in Baghdad or wherever in Afghanistan. And next thing you know, he hits the streets and is told to keep those pesky people in line in Portland. And don't you know, there's a Al-Qaeda jihadist and a white supremacist hiding behind every bush downtown Portland, you know, and both sides of the Willamette, you know, up there in those Portland Hills, don't you know, by the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. I'll bet they're really in-depth along the Wildwood Trail.
Well, and what did Poppy Bush refer to Portland as? Little Beirut.
Right. Well, and then, gosh, remember the lawyer? Supposedly his fingerprints were on a bag.
His name escapes me at the moment, but yes.
Right. And then he was arrested and thrown in jail. And then the FBI said, oh, whoops, you know, we really didn't have it. And so, that was another big Portland event. But anyway, getting back to this exercise, see, one of the patterns, incidentally, that has worried us deeply is it seems like these people like to follow a Kabbalistic code. So, like, they like numbers that are divisible by 11, like 9/11, or like March 11th, 2004, the Madrid bombing, or like the 7/7/2005, London subway bombing. So, we had the... of course, is 7/7 divided by 11. Also, they'll take digits and add them together, like 2009. This year is worrisome. You knock out the zeros in their numerology and add the digits, so 2 plus 9 is 11.
And even 9/11/73, which was the CIA overthrow of Chile.
Right. That's not, well, you actually go back very far in time. A lot of these things... the Oklahoma City bombing, the Kennedy assassination.
22.
Yep. 1222. You get all kinds of resonances. The attack on the USS Cole, which I believe was 10/12/2002. So that's 22. So, yeah, you know.
To put this into perspective, you know, they tell us that numerology and astrology is all just kind of silly and it's fun and games. But when you look at what they're into, they're really into it. Ronald Reagan wouldn't make a move without consulting his astrologer. You know, Tony and Cherie Blair will meet with their strange religious leaders. These guys are into it, but they tell us it's silly, and they'll even throw it in our faces in Hollywood movies with Nicolas Cage or Jim Carrey, and it's just entertainment.
Speaking of silliness, wasn't it so silly that George Herbert Walker Bush gave his New World Order speech on 9/11, 1990, exactly 11 yep. years before 9/11, 2001?
To the day,
exactly. But anyway, there's another interesting pattern we found. That is, they like to repeat place names, okay? So, like, you have Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Then you have New York City, New York. You know, for 9/11. And then, of course, you'd say, what about the Pentagon in Washington, D.C.? Well, that's Pentagon City, Pentagon. If you take the subway, you have the subway stop in Pentagon City, right? So then, Captain May, there have been bombs going off in Texas City, Texas, conventional bombs. We can get into that.
We have Oregon City, Oregon, just up the
right,
road.
Right, next to Oregon. And also, I was active in trying to interdict in NLE 2008, which had a nuclear biological chemical scenario. In fact, there are several thousand troops, many of them support, but other chemical warfare specialists at Fort Lewis. We had a May Day alert, May 2008. And the scenario, actually the many scenarios, but a main one was a tanker truck with extremely toxic chemicals. Initially, they're supposed to be lethal chemicals. They keep changing the scenario. When we call these people up and ask about scenarios, they have this funny way of sort of changing them around. Originally, it's a lethal plume enveloping Seattle. And that's next to, guess what? That's Lake Washington, Washington, right?
Mm.
And then, now, Chicago, as a potential target, we believe that the Chicago Sears Tower, which on March 11th, 2004, was acquired by Larry Silverstein, who was the landlord for the 9/11 World Trade Center towers.
3/11.
Right. Exactly. You'd say, well, what's the repeat name relationship there? And that's Chicago River, Chicago. The Chicago River runs right through Chicago. And it's near the Sears Tower, which, incidentally, the zip code was changed. It's been renamed the Willis Tower, but 60606 in numerology, you knock out
the zeros.
The zeros, you get 666, which you can flip that over. They like sixes and nines.
So we, of course, also the story September 9th coming up soon then as well.
Yeah, oh, well, no, we'll get to that in a sec. But you got, how many stories do you have on the Sears Tower? 110 stories. You knock out the zero, that's 11. How many stories were on each of the World Trade Center towers? 110 stories each.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 11. 11 plus it formed a big 11 in the sky.
How many floors in Building 7? 47.
One thing that, you know, Captain May has tried to issue predictions in the past where he's looked at the total number of days, like in between days, between the March 11th, 2004, and 9/11 was something like 911 days. So, you look at day intervals and this and that. To try to get some clues. I was speaking over the... let me lead up to this thing, though, this coming scenario here. Whereas, we've already discussed, they've had these events around the different countries, like at Fort Lewis for NLE 2008, and around May of 2008. Then they had the Fort Stewart exercise that was completed September 18th, 2008. Now, right now, it turns out that for this upcoming exercise here, Vibrant Response, they're going to be based at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, which is close to, guess what city?
Kansas City, Kansas.
You got it.
Ding,
bingo.
Ding, ding.
10 kiloton nuke scenario. So that got my attention. Now, in terms of timing, I asked her how they're going to run this course. And apparently, they're going to have two classes going through this two-week course. It starts on 31st of August. And they'll run one class for a week. 31st July.
Through
August 14th. Right.
Continue, sorry.
No, actually, my calendar, I just happened to have an extraneous mark by 31. But anyway, you're right, absolutely. So I was trying to think through this, what might be a potential date. Now, the public information officer said that chances are they'll pop the 10 kiloton nuke, purely hypothetical at this point, but of course we know that the way these exercises tend to overlap with reality, we have to be concerned. Early on, generally our experience is they normally don't like, well, first off, anything can happen, okay, but typically if an exercise starts on a Monday, we worry, because often, like 9/11 I believe was on a Tuesday, they need a day to get their coffee, this and that, so they'll probably need bring in students and participants on 31st, get squared away,
get everybody acclimated and comfortable,
right? But here are some things that are really disturbing us. Is they run one class through there and get these guys trained up. We've already got all these people who've been trained in FEMA Region 6 plus elsewhere around the country with NLE 2009. So now we got a class that's been trained for the first week. Then the second week rolls around. Let's say they bring in people Friday the 7th, 8th of August. And then looking at the calendar, they're going to stay the 14th. Guess what Tuesday then looks like for the second class? That would be the 11th of August.
My birthday.
Really?
Yeah.
and guess what that decodes to? That would be 8/11, and then add 2009. Not out the zeros. 2 + 9 is 11. Mm-hmm. That's 8/11/11. So that looks kind of spooky to us, to say the least.
So if I can say essentially, while we're discussing this, because now we are sort of into the realm of the speculative. What do you say, and I've dealt with this myself, what do you say to people who say that talking so much about these drills and trying to say that everyone is going to be, oh, this is it, this is going to be the one, no, this is it, that it's crying wolf?
Well, Captain May has a good comeback to that. When you firmly establish that there's a hungry wolf out there who can do you harm, is roaming out in the woods outside your home, how can you be crying wolf too much when there's a serious danger of a wolf attack? And the mere fact of brandishing a weapon or crying out would tend to scare the wolf away. And we've been told repeatedly by global media that it's not a question of if, but when we'll have a repeat 9/11. Looking at global media, back in December 2007, we had the national intelligence estimate, which came out and said that actually Iran had actually discontinued their nuclear program in around 2003, and all the talk we had from various sources about how there might be an imminent danger were very much overblown. And Captain May then predicted, he said, well, just give it a couple of years and they'll be back. And sure enough, we're hearing from so-called Israeli sources and other sources that now looks like Iran really does have a nuclear program that's a threat, and we got to deal with them. So that's heating up. So when we see these indicators, plus all the stuff that we've already discussed so far in the show of the Department of Homeland Security trying to demonize various groups in America and these other indicators, take a look at U.S. is not exactly disengaging in Afghanistan. It's been getting in deeper, involved with Pakistan. So it's hardly the case that the military-industrial complex and Israel and other interests are backing off. It looks like, if anything, they're ramping up. We were told actually back around, getting back to the Madrid bombing and March 11th, 2004, there were stories floating around about how Al-Qaeda had access to suitcase nukes. That's been largely discredited. But, a lot of things that are mythical in nature that have never been discredited, that the media is still shoving in our face. For example, let's take the bin Laden videos. There's strong evidence, Professor David Ray Griffin, that Osama bin Laden died and was buried in December 2001.
And other military officers have said the same thing.
Right. And in fact, there's also evidence that Saddam Hussein and many of his two sons and a number of his generals were killed by a bomb during the Battle of Baghdad. And the pilot who ran that mission has been identified. And that got hushed up. Joe Vials, who's Australian, he was based in Australia. Some people think maybe he had a form of Mossad connection. Pointed out that the person supposedly, who's supposed to be Saddam Hussein, had a different set of lower teeth, rather than having a straight lower teeth on the top ridges. They were kind of wavy. You can see it in the pictures. Plus, Saddam Hussein's wife, actually his widow, came to visit the individual in jail, and she came storming out saying, that's not Saddam, and that wasn't reported in the media. So one can make a case that we are being subjected to. Well, let's take Al-Qaeda. I mean, look at how so much of that was created by, funded by the CIA originally. So, Americans are being victimized by massive deception.
It's a massive psychological operation
being waged against the American people. That's exactly what's going on. So that should make people even more apprehensive. We've got to break through the propaganda matrix. We've got to de-brainwash ourselves and regain control of our destiny on a grassroots level. I mean, essentially, well, look at the whole Obama birth certificate issue. I mean, you've probably gone over that quite a lot on your show, but from all the evidence that I've heard about, serious evidence. Let's take, for example, the American Free Press had a story about how didn't he travel to, was it Pakistan around 1981? And to do that, at that time, Pakistan was on the forbidden list for U.S. citizens, which meant he either had a British passport or an Indonesian passport. Well, that right there would obstruct his claim to being a natural-born U.S. citizen, or somebody at least who retained his U.S. citizenship. But we have relatives, a grandmother, in Kenya, and other sources who swear that he was born in Kenya, not in Hawaii.
And I believe he was the one who died literally the day before the inauguration.
Yeah.
So his recent trip to Ghana, we had Ghanaian media saying it's so great to have the first African American president return to the continent of his birth, and you go, wait, what?
Right. Well, people outside the U.S. who are outside our propaganda matrix are quite often better informed than we are.
So if we can begin to wrap this up, both before me and my computer meltdown here in the legendary heat wave we're having here in Portland, Oregon, triple digit. It seems to me that what happens when one party's in and one party's out, we, of course, somehow made it through 8 years of Bush and Cheney. And when we have the Republican side, the quote-unquote conservative side, the enemy is over there somewhere. But when we shift to the quote-unquote progressive Democrats, the enemy is at home. So if you remember, during the Clinton era, all the enemies were, of course, the militias and the McVeighs and the anti-abortionists and all of those events. You shift right into the Bush years and we're off to the Middle East again. Now we're back to the supposed left, and the enemies again are the militias and right-wing extremists.
Well, I would argue that actually,
but that they play, it seems.
Yes, but another important point is this ties in with my earlier discussion about the hijacking of America. And in fact, you could argue that your straight white male America, when it was in the early 1800s, was overwhelmingly white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. Okay, I mean, the Puritans came from Eastern England, which was the most Nordic part of England. Actually, they're probably more Nordic Celtic. But, you know, most of them, their ancestors fought under Oliver Cromwell. You had the Scots-Irish along the frontier. You had the Pennsylvania Dutch, which were actually Rhine West Bank Lutherans. But as overwhelmingly Protestant, you know, white males, landowners could vote. And that's kind of where it all began. And the people on the left, particularly, you know, you have the Zionist power elite that controlled the banks, they realized that, you know, the WASP element has been in steady decline, particularly since the war between the states. And they realized that they've always realized that probably their most effective adversaries who'd want to throw them out of power in Hollywood and on Wall Street are straight white males of Northern European descent. And so they've always, they can't come out and say that openly in public, but indirectly they can attack WASPdom every other way by promoting feminism, the battle of the sexes, promoting racial envy, promoting class warfare, demonizing anything to do with right-wing groups or traditional groups, to include pro-Southern groups harkening back to the Confederacy, every possible trying to associate right-wing traditional American conservatives with neo-Nazism, with racism, xenophobia. Every trick in the book they can use to try to demonize straight white males of Northern European descent. They'll do it, and they have done it. They'll continue to do it. And we have always been, I say we because I'm part of that category, we've always been their number one enemy. And so we just continue to be their enemy. May, in a way, Janet Napolitano is doing us a favor when she starts attacking you know, returning veterans and gun owners as being potential extremists, because see, they're really more dangerous when they use their crooked indirect approach. But when they come out and it looks more and more like a direct attack on traditional American conservatives, then we really begin to see more of their true colors flying.
So as we wrap this up, I first want to say, you know, thanks so much for taking the time to do this, probably even a little longer than I thought, you know, we probably would have gone, but there's so much to go over. And again, two very different people can meet, and we can hit a lot of the same points, because ultimately the research leads you to the same conclusions, or many of the same conclusions.
Right.
And I think, you know, my weapon is this right here, what I'm doing, is it really is an information war. And I think if we can spread the word about what's going on, that's what can help people make informed, rational decisions about their lives.
Exactly, and I think that was the original intent of our republic, is to allow people to function on a grassroots level in their own best interest. And in fact, that's ultimately what it comes down to, is the people who are waging the propaganda war against us, the reason why they're doing it is they want special privilege. In other words, the people who run the central bank are engaging in a form of taxation without representation, where rather than openly, in a very open way, levying taxes, they just print money, which the impact of inflation is such that the people originally spend the dollars, they get the full purchasing power, but John Q. Public, his purchasing power gets eroded just as if he had been taxed. So, when people who run the central bank decide in their closed board meetings they're going to increase the money supply, because in the long run, inflation is a money supply phenomenon, they're engaging in taxation without representation. Now, I mean, I don't really have the time. We're wrapping up here. But I can have a very long discussion about how all these things are being done. The propaganda war, the policies of the central bank. They all come down to certain groups in our society wanting special privilege at the expense of everybody else, and ultimately wanting to brain you, John Q. Public, from being armed with the knowledge so you can do things that are in your own best interest rather than their interest. So that's what really comes down, is allowing people at the grassroots to recapture control of their destiny, as opposed to people with special privilege who are trying to rob you of your destiny, rob you of your rights, rob you of the right to know. That's how I see this whole thing ultimately boiling down.
So what are the best ways for people out there to get involved, to get in touch with you, and to help spread the word of what's going on here?
Well, we have links to the, we feel that Ghost Troop has been one of the most effective, what we call ourselves, cyber militia, whereas other groups look back at 9/11 and try to dissect it, which is good. I mean, but what we try to do is we try to be forward-looking, and there's a precious few outfits out there. Captain May has done a brilliant job of pulling together a coalition of people from all ends of the political spectrum and all different kinds of racial and ethnic backgrounds. It's a bipartisan effort of people to engage in cyber vigilance. So you have Patty Woodard is the membership coordinator and a moderator, and we run Ghost Troop boards for not only Portland. You have the Portland Nuclear Inquest, but also they've been created for Phoenix, for Chicago, and for Texas. So one way to directly be involved with our operation is just to get involved with the cyber vigilance and be contributing when we find articles. We post them on the internet to help keep each other informed. Also, another important note is, I think in the long run, it's good to engage in what I call swarm tactics or have backups. So I think that if people, for example, I encourage people to read my Mission to Conscience series. One reason why I created that is to create a turnover manual so people can learn from our experiences. But, you know, create your own group. Be creative. You know, I think that in the long run, it's many different approaches. So maybe somebody can, you know, get involved with Ghost Troop and learn the best that we have to offer, and then kind of create your own independent group. As long as we're working towards the same objective, which is to oppose tyranny and oppose the police state and the enslavement, and ultimately, these people are just criminally crazy. They're prepared to do genocide against us. I mean, that's a whole other discussion, but I mean, these people, look at how they've genocided over 1 million Iraqis with the depleted uranium and other stuff. They don't care about human life, and they don't care about us either. I mean, they launch us into hyperinflation. I don't think they would. These people, I think, are just really evil at the highest levels of power in America. They're completely psychopathic, and there are all kinds of things. That's, again, another discussion. I really prefer to lay the groundwork before I sound like I'm going too far off the deep end. But, like Captain May said, who would have imagined back in, 1912 or 1913, before the advent of World War One, all the horrors that took place in Russia through the Bolshevik Revolution. I mean, then Solzhenitsyn said, 60 million people got killed. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And so we've got to we've got for people to get active and to be educating themselves. I think you're doing fantastic work, and I think you're prime testimony how, you know, someone who, I mean, I just think it's incredibly encouraging that given that you and I have very different backgrounds, that you've really gotten up to running speed on all these topics as well as you have. I think that's fantastic. We just need for more people to be like yourself, get engaged, start learning, start asking questions, talk to friends and neighbors and relatives, and spread the word. And I guess if you got just a little more time, I can go just a little bit extra on this. So you got just a little bit more time?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, you know, because where this ultimately leads, in my opinion, is the secessionist separatist movements. And that's been going on, the sovereignty movement, okay? In fact, I talk about that in my Mission of Conscience series and what I call the Why We Fight chapter. And the concept of sovereignty, which is, I think, is one of the ultimate political concepts that we're after. Sovereignty, I view as the ability of a people to gain control of their destiny. Popular sovereignty, which goes back to early American populism in the 19th century, means the ability to determine their own destiny on a grassroots level. And there are many elements that go into that. And I make the comparison to what's called the McKinsey 7S model from the book In Search of Excellence. And the idea is that to have a... In fact, this is in Chapter 6 of my Mission of Conscience series. It's called The First Crawford Texas Protest, The Angry Letter Campaign, and Why We Fight. And that was when Captain May went out to Crawford, Texas, by the Bush White House and did a protest before Cindy Sheehan did Camp Casey. But he was there, too. That I also cover that in Mission of Conscience. But the idea is, you know, like in the book In Search of Excellence, the authors talk about how to have a successful small company. You need to pull a lot of elements together. For example, you need a structure, the company, what are called superordinate goals or values, and you obviously you need all these different things that help to make the company a growing concern. It's not just one thing, it's many things coming together. And I make an analogy with politics. I think it's no different. There are a lot of important elements that have to come together for people. In fact, okay, I've just pulled it up here on the computer screen. Let me just rattle it off. The McKinsey 7S model. Structure, systems, style, staff, skills, strategy, and shared values all have to interact and come together. And then below that, I talk about how you know, one synonym for self-determination is nationalism, which America, of course, in the hands of the global elitist, has become anti-nationalist. But the idea is that, and I go through all this, I guess we don't have time for me to spell it out here. Just please go on the internet and see where I've spelled this stuff out in some detail. But the idea is that we have to restore the ability of people to form themselves in local communities and become politically potent on a grassroots level to take control of their own destiny. In a way, it's like back to the future, where in a way it's like history going in cycles. We return to where we were in the early 19th century. Remember when Portland, actually the Pacific Northwest, you had the Oregon Republic, the Territorial Republic. Remember the Texas Lone Star Republic. Remember the Republic of Franklin, which came right after the American Revolution. Maybe remember that most Americans at the time in the American Revolution were considered anti-federalist, according to Dr. Murray Rothbard, where they felt that the states should be more powerful than the central government. True federalism means the central government is weaker than state governments, because if the federal government is more powerful, then it can start growing as it has, like a cancer. But in order to keep it in check, you have to have the state governments more powerful than the central government, which was the point made by Thomas Jefferson in the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798 that he co-authored. Actually, it's the Kentucky and Virginia Resolutions, you'll find on Wikipedia, that he co-authored with James Madison. But anyway, make a long story short is we need for people to pull themselves together. Part of using the McKinsey 7S model, like when you talk about culture and structure, you can be getting into intangible shared values like shared ethnicity. I have on my website, AmericaFirstBooks.com, I have a 30-question quiz called Have You Been Brainwashed? And I have a question about why is ethnicity important in defense of liberty, and I take a pro-con position on all these questions. So I'd invite people to read that commentary, but I think we have to begin to actually, the word reinvent sounds like we're trying something new, but actually to become more normal, we have to kind of take the best of the old with the best of the new and actually return to a lot of values that I think worked in an earlier period in American history. So we're talking about something that's really really pretty, very big and very comprehensive. And another point I'll make is, a few years ago, it would have been considered a real thought crime to talk about state sovereignty movements. But, I mean, look, recently had the governor of Texas, even though he belongs to a lot of leaders organizations, talking about asserting a Texas state sovereignty. You've had Governor Montana wanting to repudiate real ID. You have a sovereignty movement in New Hampshire. And that's, in fact, that's exactly what these people, the elitists, they want to stamp out. That's another reason why they would be more than happy to set off a 10-kiloton nuke and kill 10 or 20 or 30,000 Americans and create the police state. Because they understand that if Americans really did what was in their best interest on a grassroots level, America would become more politically decentralized and we would return probably more towards a lot of the anti-federalist views that represent the majority of Americans at the time of the American Revolution. And their agenda is the exact opposite. Their agenda is world government, it's dictatorship, it's monopoly, it's not the urge towards liberty and decentralization that characterized the American Revolution. Their agenda is to reverse the American Revolution, whereas I view my agenda as wanting to restore the principles of liberty of the American Revolution.
Well, and I think you hit it there just a few minutes ago in that getting active on our own grassroots level. And we didn't even get into, of course, all the threats to our food, but also to the growing hype of a cyber space war, some sort of I-9-11, a cyber 9-11, which I've been focusing on a bit recently on Media Monarchy as well with James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. But I end my show, my live show every week by saying, and I believe I stole it from Webster Tarpley, and that's get active or get radioactive.
Yes, and in fact, if I can make a couple more points, I know we're trying to wrap here, but when I was a stockbroker there in the Portland area, we had a policy called Adopt a City, and that is, for example, one guy adopted Tillamook, and he, at that time, before they had a no-call list, he called up people in Tillamook to try to build his book of business. But the idea is, work a local community and raise awareness. So if a lot of your people want to get active, if you got the time, is to first off access alternative media, come up to running speed of things as you're saying. There are other sources, obviously, the Lone Star Iconoclast, American Free Press, AmericanFreePress.net, Republic Broadcasting Network. I link to a lot of things in my sitemap on all ends of political spectrum at AmericaFirstBooks.com. So kind of get up to running speed, and then, going door to door. Hey, that's a proven political technique. I had a friend of mine who got elected on a state representative level in Connecticut, just going door to door. And that's the honest way to do it, is, start building political support and start educating people on a grassroots level. That is the Achilles heel. In fact, I attended a conference where some very seasoned political activists said, as much money as the people in these elite power groups, the Bilderberg Group, Trilateral Commission, you name it, they can't, their Achilles heel is they can't do the face-to-face on the grassroots level and mobilize, particularly in the local city and state political offices. So maybe running for local office or even becoming a state representative, that'll give you at least an opportunity, people who are activists, to educate people. Another point is I think we should emphasize that it's not futile. That we outnumber some of these unspeakably evil people at the top who are trying to destroy our liberty, and that ultimately through power numbers. And if we can maintain the free internet, that's critically important. It does work to conduct phone campaigns. For example, I've been supporting Reverend Pike, Ted Pike's efforts. I have an archive for him to try to prevent hate crime legislation from going through, which we believe is a Trojan horse effort to try to eliminate the First Amendment. So, according to Reverend Pike, who's based, incidentally, there in he's in East Portland area, Clackamas, I believe. But anyway, he says that actually what's more effective than writing letters is to actually call congressmen. So basically what we're doing is we're getting back to just the real bread and butter of grassroots political organizing, local political office, going door to door, raising your own awareness. I think one of the biggest problems in America is so many Americans have just become lazy. They expect the federal government to take care of everything for them, to tie their shoestrings for them. And we need to restore the attitude that we need to take control of our own lives on a local level and politically organize and politically mobilize and get active. And if we do that, we can face these people down. In fact, we believe with Ghost Troop, another important reason why I did the Mission of Conscience series is to provide evidence that Captain May was successful in running his campaigns and by anticipating and exposing the designs of a lot of these high-level malefactors, he caused them to back down. And I think there's strong evidence that, in fact, I think that Captain May deserves Leon Smith, the publisher of the Lone Star Iconoclast, has requested a congressional investigation. I created the Mission of Conscience series to help provide evidence to support such, to help provide adequate proof in such an investigation. But, you know, Captain May is worthy of a congressional medal honor, a civilian equivalent like a congressional gold medal. We think there's a strong chance that he has helped prevent a 9/11. Repeat 9/11 to date by just being on the ball and being very active, not taking no for an answer. And we just need more people to do that. And if we can get enough people and stay on these evil people at the highest levels, we can win. And that is the can-do message that I'd like to make sure that I'm part in closing.
I think that's probably the best way to wrap this up. So I really appreciate, again, on somewhat short notice, taking this time to do this talk, because this information is critically important. From Oregon to Texas to all around the country, there is this general feeling of being on edge. And again, I think the drills and everything else kind of capitalizes on the fear pandemic that we're experiencing.
So, yeah, we can't allow ourselves to be paralyzed. We have to overcome the fear and take the attitude. The greatest thing to fear is fear itself. And that, if anything, they should be afraid of us because they are the criminals. They are the malefactors. They are the psychopaths. They're the ones who've done evil things, not us. We have nothing to be afraid of. We are standing up for all the finest principles of America and the American Revolution. So we have everything that's good and noble on our side.
Absolutely. William Fox, thanks so much for appearing here on Media Monarchy. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, too. I appreciate it as well. Thank you very much.
All right, man. Take care.
All right. Take care, too. Bye.
This is an African tribal chant.
How would you explain it?
Combining music and stylized images.
It's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
Say out on my track.
And that concludes our program for tonight.
Yo. This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.